One basic reason for this necessity of constant prayer is the inevitability of conflict, which the supernatural life must face. Not unlike the struggle for survival that is common to all living things, from the lowest among the animal species to the physical well-being of man. There are few things on which Christ was more insistent than the universal visitation of trials to be experienced by those who follow Him and live by His Spirit. One are the 8 Beatitudes, but a summary of the difficulties and obstacles to be overcome by the faithful Christian. Christ spoke of persecution for justice' sake, of being brought before tribunals, and put to death for belief in His name. And let's not for a moment suspect that this was said only for the first 3 centuries of the Christian era. It was said for today, which I call the Age of Martyrs. Christ foretold the inner struggle within men's hearts when they are torn between fidelity to Him and to their relatives, friends, and all natural loves, of the need His disciples would have of patience under duress, in which alone they would possess their souls. His parable of the seed which fell amid thorns and briars was to stress the conflict that following the gospel brings with the world, the flesh, and the evil spirit. In the Lord's Prayer, He epitomized this militia Christiana, Christian warfare, by bidding us pray not to be led into temptation and to be delivered from evil. In a word, He came. Do we hear it? This is the Prince of Peace. As He said in one mysterious passage, to bring not peace, but the sword. All of this is part of Christ's prophecy, and if we are faithful to Him, of our experience. But our powers alone, that is, our natural powers, are unequal to the responsibility of so many and varied contests. Consequently, as we must ask God for our daily sustenance of the body, when we pray, "Give us this day our daily bread," so we must pray to Him for strength of soul, that we may be sustained in virtue. And when we make that petition, let's keep in mind we are praying for 2 kinds of bread. Bread for the body and bread for the soul. Hence, that universal condition and law of our supernatural life, which is a perpetual warfare. Let me add, if we are trying to be faithful to Christ. We are going to be in conflict with the same world that destroyed Him. It will try to destroy us. Given this warfare, we see the indispensability of prayer. By way of epilogue, I would like to draw a few salutary implications from all of this for sound Catholic religious education. If, as our faith teaches us, we live a life of grace which needs to be sustained and developed at every chronological age of our natural life, for every psychological condition of person being educated, from the retarded child to the university graduate, and in whatever sociological milieu the child or young person, or for that matter, the adult, may happen to live, if all of this is true, then Catholic education worthy of the name, especially, I might even say mainly concerned, to so teach the faith that the one who learns it will put it into virtuous practice. That's the term, virtuous practice. And he will do this only, which I've underlined in my manuscript, only if he has been trained to use the sacraments, notably frequent confession and communion, and to pray. Given this kind of training, the supernatural life of grace will not only be preserved in spite of trials and conflict, but, would you believe it, will grow and develop precisely because of the struggle. Here, if anywhere, the Darwinian law of survival holds true. Only the strong survive. And strength in the life of grace comes through the channels of grace. How so? Because Christ, who works through the sacraments and always responds to prayer, will provide the light and the strength that only He can give to maintain and increase that divine life which He alone conferred in the first place. Thank you for listening to me. The first question reads, if a mass offered for a particular deceased person is sufficient to free this soul from purgatory, why, then, has the custom of priests saying three Masses on November the 2nd prevailed? And the next question is tied in with the first. If a Mass truly has infinite value, I find it difficult to attend more than one daily. Please comment. First of all, we've got to distinguish within the Mass between two kinds of value.
Objectively, every mass has infinite value. Why infinite? Because it is a reenactment of Calvary. The same priest, the same victim, Jesus Christ. Because he is God, his death, or the representation of his death in the Mass, objectively has infinite value or capacity for redeeming 1,000 worlds. But subjectively, each Mass is to be applied according to the dispositions, the subjective condition, the moral attitude of soul, the detachment from creatures, which the people for whom the Mass is offered, the priest who offers the Mass, or those who assist at Mass, possess. And consequently, though objectively each Mass is infinite, the attendance at more than one Mass, or the having of many Masses said for a particular person or his intention, is valid, because though objectively one Mass would be enough, the person's dispositions determine always a finite fruit or benefit, as we say, from the Mass. As regarding the three Masses to be said on November the 2nd, it is a privilege which each priest has. The custom is not so ancient. I might just explain what the intentions are, as specified by the Church. One of the three Masses which a priest may offer on November the 2nd is, or maybe for his own intention, some particular soul, his father or mother or someone that he wants the Mass to be offered for. The second must be for all the souls in purgatory. And the third, and this may not be common knowledge, is to offer the Mass for the intention of the Holy Father, to make up for whatever Masses may not have been offered, for which stipends or donations had been made. And a priest died, or apostatized, or simply neglected to offer the Mass. Consequently, the custom of offering three Masses on November the 2nd goes back to the time when the Church decided that it would be well to have Masses said by all the priests throughout the Catholic Church for all the souls in purgatory, and to make up for the unsaid Masses for which offerings had been made. Would you trace the history of the development of the sacrament of penance? An adequate answer to this question would be to write a book, in fact, several volumes. Let me just say a few words. There are really two histories to the sacrament of penance. The one is better known, the other is less well known. The better known history, which is now being used by some who are critical of children's confessions and early confession and frequent confession, that history of the sacrament of penance tells us that in the early Church, confession was not so frequent, that people would go to confession when they had grave sins, indeed had committed some public crime, like murder or adultery, or I might add, abortion. And that gradually, from people going less frequently, because quite obviously they did not often commit big crimes, in time, Christians went to confession more often. And so the explanation goes, that's how we got into the habit of going to confession frequently. And consequently, the suggestion is that we ought to go back to the original practice, which means infrequent confession, and you better be sure you've got a big crime to confess before you go. The other history of confession, or of the sacrament of penance, says that from the earliest times, people had been in the habit of confessing their sins, even though they did not commit a grave crime. The habit grew up out of the monastic and religious life that started very early in Christian history. This history of the sacrament of penance meant that people who sought to purify their souls, reduce their venial sins, and receive special grace from this sacrament would go to confession even though they did not have grave sins on their souls, less still crimes. In fact, may not even have remembered some conscious, deliberate sin since their last confession, would nevertheless confess some sin from their past life and receive grace. Why? Because, so this history of the sacrament of penance tells us, this sacrament has two purposes. The one, following the first history, the remission of grave sin by divine law. But a second purpose, to grow in holiness, to obtain grace. And consequently, even a young child with its peccadilloes, no grave sin, is, so the church teaches, to receive confession once he reaches the age of discretion, because he needs help from the sacrament to overcome temptation and to cope with the difficulties of his growing childhood. What are your thoughts on Teilhard de Chardin? Would you consider him the high prophet of the so-called new religion? It seems that many nuns, in particular, consider him a saint. He is being taught in the local high schools and also in the university. A more complete development of my thoughts on Teilhard de Chardin, a fellow Jesuit, can be found in my book, Christianity in the 20th Century. There are two sides to Chardin. There is the believing, pious, spiritual, and I trust, sincerely Christian side. There is another side, the speculative, the purportedly scientific, the highly philosophical. The first side I can dismiss, except to say that I think there was this side to Chardin, as revealed in many of his private letters to his friends. However, it's the other side of Chardin that I think hath made him a prophet in many circles. On this second side, he teaches, depending on where you look, but he teaches complete cosmic evolution. Now, this is more than most people suspect. It is not merely that man on his bodily side developed from a lower species, anthropological evolution, which is at least a tenable theory. According to absolute and complete evolution, everything in the universe, and the word is everything, is in the process of becoming. There are those, his Christian admirers, at least most of them, who claim that Chardin excluded from the process of evolution the deity. There are others, however. Huxley, for example, would be one who wrote his introduction to Chardin's Phenomenon of Man. And Christians, too, who claim that Chardin explicitly taught that even God is part of the evolutionary process. In other words, that the infinite God of Judeo-Christianity is a thing of the past, that the God of the future, of the so-called new religion, is a God in process, and that we, by our free volition, individually and collectively, contribute to the process. I need not say that on this second level, Chardin is not suitable diet for any Catholic educational institution.
This tape was produced by Select Religious Recordings. All rights are reserved. Duplication or transcription in any form is strictly prohibited.